Welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversation, Season 7. Before we begin, we must not forget that we are living and working on Sukapmakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Shkwepik people. It's clear that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, today we have as our guest someone who, in many ways, epitomizes a commitment to engaging in public service. Dave Ganella is a counselor for the city of Salmon Arm, the executive director of Salmon Arm's famous Roots and Blues Festival, and as if that wasn't enough, he's just taken on the role of culture and events director for the BC 55 Plus Games, the largest annual multi-sport event for the province's 55 plus population. Oh, and I forgot to mention that Dave is currently acting as deputy mayor of Salmon Arm. So welcome, Dave, to Food Conversations.
Thank you, Dr. Bell, for having me.
So what we're going to promise you is a peaceful hour of just sitting and chatting, no prep time, no organizational demands, and no policy decisions. Can you handle that?
I can handle that. Thank you.
I'm very delighted to hear that. Now, you actually have an article coming out shortly in The Observer, and it talks about some things that are really important to you at this time, and centered around the impacts of the climate crisis, which is looming larger in our lives all the time. Do you want to just say a few words about why you're putting that piece out and why you're putting it out now?
It's relevant. I think that's probably where I would like to start with that. And something I've been, I think, personally grappling with for quite a while. This is not something new. How to articulate it, I think that's been, I've been able to summarize what parts of it is actually what I want to focus on. This is something I've been thinking about for a long time. I mean, I can remember it as a kid in the 70s watching, you know, animal shows, and they would, you know, the Omaha Wild World of Animals show, wherever that was.
Yeah, Walt Disney had some movies on animal stuff.
Yeah, and just the correlation where, you know, that the natural world is being, you know, changed. And that's something I've, you know, sort of grown up with.
Now, we're going to end up talking about the City of Salmon Arm's new plans to develop a food and urban agriculture process. But first, it might be valuable to talk a little bit about public service, because you're enmeshed in public service at the level of the community, the level of the community government, and now a sporting event. What has led you to kind of this point? It didn't start out this way, but what is it about public service that has become increasingly important to you?
Not standing on the sidelines and letting others who, you know, may or may not have the same opinion or background make decisions. I think it's a time that the older I have gotten and the more I think about it is this is the moment that we need to make change. And being on the sidelines and hoping for the best is just not good enough anymore.
And I think a lot of people are starting to feel that way. They realize that these are times of transformational change. They're not just, you know, modest change. They are change of the system from top to bottom. Now, like most people who have been on the show, you started in a different space, both geographically and in terms of your sort of focus and interests, but with other concerns in the background. Initially, after you left school, you went to study fine arts at San Francisco State University in the early 1990s, and then went on to do a master's degree at UBC in the same field. What at that time were you heading towards? What was the focus in your pursuit of these particular studies? What were you thinking of?
I think that my pursuit through my film career was a lot about having an opportunity to self-evaluate. I find that now I look back on it, it was always individual stories. It was always stories of, you know, people being in positions where they had to overcome something. I think that was, you know, my background. Both of my grandparents on my Italian side were immigrants, so they traveled. And then my grandparents on the other side, although they had been in North America for a few, you know, centuries, they had experienced the dust bowls. They were in the panhandle of Oklahoma. They made, you know, their travels to California to have a taste of the peaches, as those ads would show. ended up New Mexico, in a place called Carlsbad, and they were cotton sharecroppers, and both sides of my family come from farming. So that's something I've, you know, grown up with.
What parts of the world did they come from?
Well, on my mother's side, they were from Great Britain, mostly. And then my other side is very clearly they came from the northern part of Italy, from a town called Genoa. So
it's, yeah. Named after the family.
Yeah.
What kind of connection did you have to farming as you were growing up? What did you see and sense?
The small town that I'm from is actually Merced County, which is pretty, it's like the heart of agriculture in the San Joaquin Valley. All my friends, I mean, most of my friends were farmers, and, you know, just the experience of just driving them home and, you know, just hanging out with them from kids. I was driving a tractor with my grandfather. He would put me on the tractor, set me straight, come back in about 10 minutes because these acreages were huge, and turn me around, and I would go straight again for another 15 minutes as he went off to work on repair something. So those are really some of my earliest memories.
A light touch sense of direction.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do on the farm yourself? I mean, obviously you drove a tractor.
My experiences were limited because my dad was from that generation that was getting off the farm. They thought the suburban life was the life. So I grew up, you know, classic 80s kid, you know, Ataris, Suburban, BMXs, you know, pretty carefree, you know, mostly a latch key kid.
Because they were so busy.
We would call them free range. Well, they're from they're from that generation that, you know, you'd be in at this certain time. We were a generation that would never tell a parent that some other kid did something, because most of the time we would all be in trouble for bringing it up. So we were pretty independent. Collective punishment. And, you know, every afternoon was the Lord of the Flies episode, more or less. So
was it also something that you should get some academic background, that it was? Lots of immigrant families have strong feelings about that. You don't want to be working with your hands. You want to work with your brain, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that definitely my older sister, she's the one who really broke out. She went to the University of Berkeley. So she was the one in my generation that went to university. My parents, they graduated from high school, but they were the generation that got married, found a job, worked, raised their families, did the best they could. So that education part was more my generation. They really pushed us. They had done the jobs with their hands.
Yeah.
They wanted, you know, it was to go to university. They weren't really clear about what at university they wanted us to do. Nor, I remember doing my applications to university. They didn't really understand, you know, the process or, you know, the costs.
They just wanted you to do it.
People who went to college were successful. That was their direct line.
Yeah, we're still dealing with the hangover of that and starting to recognize that there are other skills that are really just as important as academic skills. What when you were doing your first degree, which was Bachelor of Fine Arts at San Francisco State University, what were you focused on? And you could do lots of different things. Fine arts covers a big area. What were you really focused on?
That one, I mean, again, it was film. Writing and directing, but more on the production side. San Francisco State is famous for being an experimental film school. So it was in that way it was impactful in a sense of, you know, giving you an idea what could be possible, because I've always been someone who liked abstract art. So experimental film kind of fit there. But even then I was looking at narratives, and the school wasn't known for doing narratives at all. So we would make these stories, and it was just kind of like they didn't know what to do with it. We were the radicals doing a narrative at an experimental school,
really?
Which was just kind of on top of its head, kind of flipped on its head.
I think of Italian films almost always full of narratives and full of human stories.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you crossed the border at the end of your bachelor's degree and came to UBC to do an extension, a master's degree in fine arts. Mm-hmm. Were you still in film, and were you starting to move towards narrative, or was it still the technical side? And
no, the technical side came pretty easy for me, I would say, and that's just, you know, all due humility saying that, and modesty, is I had the the benefit that my brother and his friends were all in racing. So I was on a pit crew. So that was actually my formative working experience, working with a crew under serious duress and stress and having fun doing it. So when I went to San Francisco State and then eventually to UBC, that experience of working in crews gave me sort of an edge on like project management and production management, just seeing how teams have to interconnect and the effort level. I think that was the one thing I could bring from having parents who are working class, is that at the university, I was able to work at a level. I think that gave me an advantage. And I always felt like that was one thing I always had in the back of my mind. If it came down to it, I could outwork you. That was always the kind of grinder mentality that I have.
Well, you're certainly doing your best to keep up with your own tradition with all the jobs you're doing right now.
Yeah, questionably, yes. Yeah.
I'll remind listeners once again that I'm sitting with Dave Gunella, who is a counselor with the city of Salmon Arm, and as well the executive director of Salmon Arm's Roots and Blues Festival. Now, you also said when we talked a little bit before the show, you said that food had always been sort of a background awareness. Obviously, if you grow up in a farming family, food is the way of life. But what were you, even then, were you having some thoughts about food and farming? Or was it, were you really kind of developing this fine arts film project of your life?
I think there are separate lanes. I had the benefit of having grandparents who are from the Depression. I say that as a benefit, and parents who were born before World War II. So they were born during the Depression. So food and the conversations about food. And I remember my Nona, she would talk about having a birthday party and being given an apple. And that was a coveted prize. That puts in perspective, you know, right? I mean, I have probably a drawer full of, you know, in our fridge, apples. And, you know, my kids, you have to kind of force them to eat them. So, it's, you know, just a, and so I know that that contrast and being from a place that's agricultural, right? The importance of food and, you know, it's something that's always been, I'm acutely aware and I can almost, it feels like I can just feel the strain when, you know, that, like, especially with these food prices, I just have nothing but empathy for people who are struggling with that.
And World War II for your parents, what did that bring about in their consciousness?
Well, my mother was pretty young, so she was probably five when it happened, and my dad was a couple years older, but his birthday was December 7th, and for a long time, he thought somehow it was connected to his birthday that the war happened, because everyone was, you know, as being a small kid, he was, you know, deeply affected by that, and they, you know, that was their upbringing, you know, they you know, we would go to the Legion, and, you know, the experience of that was profound at that point.
What did it give you as a child a sense of, you know, when they were talking about the war and their experiences, did it give you a sense of, I don't know, some fragility in the world, that things don't always go well, that things could go right off the rails?
I don't think I need to hear much from them. If you looked at the local news in the 70s, every 5 o'clock, Walter Cronkite would be speaking and we would watch a show, the news, and they would show you all the clips from Vietnam. And, you know, and they would leave nothing out. I mean, it's really hard to imagine what they used to show just on general TV in the States during that era.
Now, up to the point where you came to UBC, you lived all your life in the States, in California. What was it that happened when you came across to this amusing country and and saw a different kind of world? What made it possible for you then and later to say, okay, maybe I'll come here and live?
Well, I think I was really strongly pursuing my film career. And because they had a program, once you graduated from the master's program, you had the opportunity to, you know, get a one-year employment visa. So I pursued that and was lucky enough that a talent agency in Vancouver, Kirk Talent Agency, thought they wanted to help cultivate my my career, and they hired me to have a job, and I was at the front desk working with 12 different female agents. Which was its own kind of amazing experience. But luckily, I grew up with, you know, a family of Italian women, and nothing really surprised me about who's in charge and how is this going to happen. So that was that experience. And I was, you know, still trying to pursue making music videos and, you know, that whole experience.
And it was quite a serious part of your life at that time.
It was.
The involvement carried over as you sort of fleshed out the plan of staying in Canada. What sort of film work were you doing? It was quite ambitious, some of it.
Well, I was working on my own stuff and then working with other filmmakers as like on the tech side, the crew side. But during that period, I was very fortunate to be hired by the Vancouver International Film Festival. And that was because of the connection there. And that job, I was initially the travel coordinator. So I would, organize people. And that grew into the guest coordinator. And I was there for a couple years. And that experience is what actually I built upon to when we moved to Salmon Arm. That's how I had the background experience to do the volunteer coordinator job at the Folk Music Society.
And you said
that many years ago.
You said that the San Francisco State University was focused on unusual filmmaking.
Experimental. Yeah.
But you were drawn to narrative. Did you find that was developing over time and influencing you both in what you're doing with filmmaking, but also in what you were thinking about you wanted to do more broadly?
Mm-hmm. I think, when you're pursuing, film is an art. When you're pursuing it, you're not at the time identifying why you're doing it. I think that that's, when you say your plan,
loosely called plan, but what were you thinking about? What were the things that really drew you in and said, well, this is special?
Yeah, I think it's the storytelling, the character building, the human interest story. Those were the things I always wanted to pursue, and still do in a sense. Like, that's funny. Once you get to catch the film fever, it never goes away. I'm just waiting for the right story to tell.
Well, there's the one thing about this program, Food Conversations, is that it is a storytelling process in the sense that people who come on the show have a narrative of their own, which is often very, my favorite term here is serendipity. It's loaded with serendipity, but the serendipity just probably means the universe is unfolding as it should, but we just don't know what it's actually doing. So what year did you actually officially start to live in Canada? At the end of your master's?
No, it would be, so 97 is when I graduated and applied for my job visa, the employment visa. So that ran to that year I applied for permanent residency. And that I didn't become a citizen until, I think, 2008. I just didn't get around to doing it.
Now, you'd actually moved to Salmon Arm at that point.
Yes.
A couple of years earlier.
Yeah, we lived in East Van of Vancouver. Me and Ellen, my very wonderful lady, and she's from this region, and she knew, and I'm from a town that, is very small, I understand small towns, and I like the way they work, to be, for a lot of reasons, I like the way they are.
So were you sort of, was it her coming home to her familiar community that was the impetus for you moving to this part of the world? Or did you see it and say, I love it?
Well, interesting enough, we were canvassing sort of like, around Canada of places we would like to live. We actually heavily considered moving to Halifax. Hmm. That was up there. We looked at Nelson. That was another space. But Ellen really wanted to be closer to her parents who were living in Coldstream at the time, and now Armstrong. Hmm. So that was, definitely impetus, but, she was, we have to have good schools, there has to be a hospital, we want to have a place, if we're broke, has nice, it's a nice place to live. And funny enough, I remember her telling me that there's this music festival there. And I thought, well, I'm from the art scene, cultural scene. There's probably enough people there I can get along with. I could probably find some kind of friends, because that was my concern. I just don't want to come here and become like just not know anybody.
Sure.
So funny enough, that was what actually drew me, was that was the last little caveat. That was like, okay, there's, they've done this and it's pretty amazing. And I'd say still is.
Now, somewhere in the middle of all this, you went to BCIT and took a sort of workshop of 5-day workshop, I believe it is, on becoming a project management professional. Mm-hmm. Was obviously you'd done a lot of the stuff that would be course content, but what did that do for you in terms of formalizing some of your on the job experience?
Well, I think it's you know, lifelong learning is important. I think it's also like looking at my own functions and looking at another opportunity to see the same functions from a different perspective and how they actually, the process they follow. And that's why I actually did the project management, because I, at first I thought it was for events and not realizing it was for IT. So I'm in the middle of this and, you know, the instructor was saying like, you know, this is project management. This is a real true viable way of organizing events and organizations in general. So I've taken a lot of those parts of it, because it's pretty complex to be a professional. You know, yeah. They call them PMPs.
Yes. Yeah. I had to look it up, PMP. Mm-hmm. Postmenopausal, I had lots of thoughts about that.
Yeah, that's not it.
Didn't fit.
Yes, that's fair. Yeah, way off.
So the Roots and Blues was available. What did you do? Walk and say, hey, I'd like to be executive director.
Friend of mine who I went to school with is Peter Greer. His father is Boyd Greer, a well-known math teacher that, you know, even my friends now still cringe about taking his math class. And his lovely wife, Barbara Greer. She went out of her way to find me and Ellen jobs when we moved here. Because me and Ellen, of course, because we didn't have children, thought, let's just sell our house and move to another place without no jobs, which now that plan itself seems incredibly insane to me. Like, what? What? But we lucked out. So we moved here again, like in the fall, kind of the August time frame. And it was January. Barbara called me up and said, there's a position at the Folk Music Society for the, you know, volunteer coordinator. You should apply. I've already spoken about you to them.
Now, was this when it had expanded to its current format, or is it still at the Salmar Theater?
Well, it was 5 years post. So it was actually technically six, because when they went from the 9th to the 10th event, the 10th event was the first event outside. Mm-hmm. If I recall correctly.
Right.
But between that, they had a year off. So I arrived the 15th annual, and I don't think I even made it across the field. I don't remember the main stage at all that year. It was such a blur. Yeah.
What did that do for your interest in narrative and people and personalities and stuff like that?
Well, I mean, I've always enjoyed, you know, people in general, just to hear their stories. The thing I actually first did when I came, when I started on the Folk Music Society, the organization, was form a youth documentary team, kind of taking my film background. And that was a lot of fun. And I think it was like seven students, youth students from the high school. We worked together. We built they built the storyline. I kind of guided them through the tech, and they worked all like for the rest of the year after the event to edit. I would meet them on Saturdays. They would come and edit, and we had machines that you had to save every 5 seconds or it would crash. But we got through, and that's so long ago now.
Well, it sounds pretty fresh in your mind.
Yeah.
I remind listeners once again that I'm speaking with Dave Ganella, who is counselor for the city of Salmon Arm and the executive director of Salmon Arm's Roots and Blues, which is why he can talk with great intimate connection to that event. Mm-hmm. And also I should mention that he is, as we speak, currently the deputy mayor of this fine metropolis of Salmon Arm. Mm-hmm. Now, one thing is happening very close to the physical site where the Roots and Blues takes place is that there is a plan to put in a garden. Mm-hmm. A garden, and we're going to come back to food a little bit for a moment. I know that Jim McEwen, who's the fair coordinator, has played a big role in encouraging this development. Talk about that a little bit, and what's your sense of that, the role of the garden, and what it does for you in terms of your own interests?
Yeah, Jim's done some really good work there to, you know, include the Food Action Society.
Indeed.
It's needed. I think it's the wonderful first step in supporting, small scale urban agriculture.
And in regard, the garden is called the John McLeod Community Garden. Mm-hmm. And John McLeod was one of the, probably the major progenitor for the Shuswap Food Action Society, yep. back when it was called the Shuswap Food Action Co-op. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the fair is created by the Shuswap Agricultural Association. So there's food is central to this whole space and mm-hmm. also to the activism that the Shuswap Food Action Society is pursuing right now.
Yep.
So how did, were you in any way involved in the process, or did you watch it from afar and see it evolving?
I met Melanie Bennett, who is the coordinator, project coordinator of the project. I chair the Agricultural Advisory Committee, and that's where that connection started. And so we know each other, and it came down to kind of how I meet a lot of people in town is that they have sort of something they need to get done, and they trying to figure out how do we get linkage to make it happen. We were in the middle of a project. We were expanding our office through a grant, infrastructure grant. So we had about 12 dump loads of dirt. And so she asked, you know, we had that trucked over. And our crew, luckily working with Brent Moffitt and the foundational Okanagan College's foundation program, we have the students, and they're actually during certain stages of the construction have been helping on that project to build planter boxes.
So to put it broadly speaking, there's a lot of influences have played into this place, this garden place being set up. Mm-hmm. It's groups that have been in the community for a long time, groups that are relatively new. And it's a structure that obviously is going to have an impact. There is a community teaching garden, which mm-hmm. is on the end of 30th Street near 60th. And so it's well out of the center of town. This mm-hmm. this site is right downtown. It's kitty corner from the food garden, which is outside the Salvation Army base. And so it's adding yet another element that's in a very public space, in a very visible space, where people will be growing food. And clearly there's a movement in that direction. We've interviewed many people on the show who are talking about the regeneration, the rebuilding of the local food growing and production systems. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that having a garden that's used by members of the public and is also in a very public space is adding visibility to something that we are moving towards all the time, which mm-hmm. is more and more local food production, more mm-hmm. and more community-based production of the things that matter to the community. And food has to be one of the things that's really important. And especially when you're talking about the background of your parents and your grandparents, both the Depression and World War II, being aware of the fact that the supply system can be fragile. And if it's very long and very tortuous, that's not a good thing. Mm-hmm. And we've all had an experience with in 2021, November 2021, when the atmospheric rivers took out the highways.
Yes.
And that created a sudden awareness in many people. And then afterwards, of course, I guess people forgot about it.
Yeah, I think it starts with the idea that Salmon Arm has only so many road linkages, and those linkages could be cut off. And they could be cut off for up to a week at minimum, but at worst could be longer. We have to be prepared to feed this area. So, I mean, food scarcity will cause a massive emergency. So to go back to this plot that's being developed behind the SASLA building, that Food Action Committee, Food Action Society program, brings back the idea of the Victory Garden. It brings back this idea that individuals can control their own food supply. And I think that is really key to having your own sense of power in your own life. And that success, this is my hope, is that success can breed a larger plots that can be broken into like half acre pieces. And that could grow into an idea that Salmon Arm, the Shuswap, is this sustainable food hub that can be something that can encourage other cities to adapt and try. Because I look, you know, when I'm driving through the suburb, you know, this how our city is set up. And so, you know, all the houses are close proximity. We all have these, you know, ornamental lawns in front. Those are all plots. Everybody, like, I want to kind of change it on its head that we're all farmers. We just farm different things. Right now, everyone seems to be into bluegrass as their main yielding crop that pays poorly, and all it takes is money.
And hard to eat.
So in that sense, it's kind of the farmer tradition. Mm. But if you look at that yard, and we can somehow re-envision it for food production, we will, you know, we're going to retain water. We're going to control erosion. We're going to, you know, build up the experience. And, you know, gardens are great community builders, just themselves. They bring people together. They bring families closer together. I just think long term, that is where we need to be moving.
This is very much in line with a sentence I'm just going to read out from the article that will be coming out in the Observer that you've written. Faced with the presence of a climate crisis, I am deeply concerned. I'm not personally doing enough to support the changes we have to make to ensure future generations can enjoy the health and prosperity past generations came to expect rolling into the next generation. And I think, and the next sentence says, unless we all look at the climate emergency as the unique species-altering event it is, then we can expect more abject suffering along with the increase in wildfires, heat domes, diminishing freshwater supplies, food shortages, etc. I mean, I think you're reflecting sentiments, and because you're in a position of a public role, you obviously would hear from the public in one way or another from time to time. And it seems to me that the general atmosphere now in terms of thinking and reflecting on what goes on in a community is that we are going through a big transition, and mm-hmm. we have to adapt to it. And not only that, we have to try and mitigate the transition as much as possible. Mm-hmm. In your piece, you mentioned adaptation is an important issue. Mitigation is prevention. In my line of work as a mm-hmm. physician, mm-hmm. it's much smarter to do prevention than it is to, you know, do major surgery and corrective interventions. And so it seems to me that whether this garden, the John McLeod Community Garden, or a number of other initiatives in community plays the lead, they all play the same role, which mm-hmm. is to bring us to more food sovereignty, food security and food sovereignty. Food sovereignty meaning that it's our food. We get to choose what kind of food it is. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about how the policy that you're instrumental in bringing forward, at least the motion that will lead to policy change. Now, there's a couple things about this. First of all, that the notion of having the municipality take on the role of directing food policy and playing an active protagonist role isn't entirely new. When the Food Action Society was first formed, there was an event that took place called Food for Thought. It was held at the United Church, which is where we are now. This meeting took place about 10 years ago in March of 2014. And at this event, there were 200 people who attended, which for a small town like Salmon Arm is a pretty sizable number of local citizenry. And the guest speaker was Laura Kalina, who's a writer, and she's been a nutritionist, a community health nutritionist, and she was the founder of the Kamloops Food Policy Council. And she pointed out a couple of main truths. One was that she said, in BC, we only produce about 48%, just under 50% of all the food we eat in the province. And she said one thing that was somewhat prophetic. She said, if there was an earthquake in near Hope, then in 3 days, the food shelves would be empty. Now, she said in Kamloops, but as mm-hmm. it turns out, it was also true in Salmon Arm. And of course, we had our own version of an earthquake. It was the two atmospheric rivers in succession in November 2021 that washed out all the north-south highways in the province, exactly what Laura Kalina had predicted for 10 years earlier. She was talking about challenging what she called a very vulnerable industrial food system. And I know that farming has changed and that the farms that you grew up with are starting to be challenged by new ideas. And you've actually kind of challenged them here today when you said, get an acreage and break it up into small plots and you know, half-acre parcels. Why don't you talk about that sense of transition that you have observed from California, San Joaquin Valley, to what's happening now in a town like Salmon Arm, similar small town? What do you see? What are you observing as an observer of this process?
Well, I mean, where I'm from, it's all monocultural farming, and we're at least 3,000 acres of the same crop. That's a little bit different here because we don't have the same sizes. So what I've seen locally, and I cite Mike Schroeder's farm, is someone who's taken the path to do everything organic. He's creating his own organic feed, doing, you know, following organic, you know, policy on how he's activating his farm. That is something that you can take a lot of, I take a lot of faith in. I don't really come from a position of pointing fingers in a sense that it doesn't, I don't find it productive. I always try to lean on the solution side, saying mm-hmm. this is what we could do to you know, solve a scenario. So, and also, frankly, I'm not an expert. I mean, you know, I was, you know, got enough votes to get in this position, had something that I wanted to work on, which was, you know, food security was on my list. And then I asked to be on the city's agricultural advisory committee. And the first thing was, how do we put the conversation of food security on a municipal level? And the first thing one of the first acts we pursued was, within 4 months of joining, we changed the terms of reference, had the idea of food security added to those terms of reference.
So I hadn't actually been part of it.
Wasn't part of it.
Interesting.
So I identified that as quickly the one thing we can do to, now the city has to hear it because it's part of our terms of reference. So once we had that, I did a notice of motion, followed that process. Aaron Jackson, the chief administrative officer of the city, was a huge help for me to navigate that whole motion process. And these are like little fundamental things that, like, here I am now speaking with you, Warren, because of that, those little subtle changes. It's just mm-hmm. looking at the system that's in front of us. We're not going to change the whole system overnight. That's not going to happen. But there are mechanisms that we can take, steps we can take, and just know what lane we're in. And that's not a negative. It's just saying, this is what I'm capable of doing now, and I can make these steps. And frankly, I'm someone who's very a major introvert. Like, this is way outside my comfort level doing any of this. And, you know, my staff, who's probably here, thinks it's hilarious that I'm even on council in public eye.
You know, Dave, I can tell you that a lot of people who are playing major roles in public spaces would cheerfully characterize themselves as introverts. And we've had several people on the show who've said, just in case you're wondering, I'm really an introvert. Mm-hmm. And they're doing a lot of public speaking. They're doing a lot of public presentations. They're engaged in public processes. And somebody has said that it's introverts who actually come up with all the best ideas, because it means you spend a lot of time thinking about things instead of just yammering away like an extrovert would do and without as much thought. Now, I think that's a bit of a broad characterization. But turning to just the process, process that you know, there was already this kind of momentum building about a decade ago. But when you're in public office, there's always competing interests, and they always intermesh in sometimes visible, sometimes invisible, sometimes scrutable, sometimes inscrutable ways. I'm wondering if you could, from what you've seen of the process and seeing the startup of the Food Action Society and seeing the pivotal role it's played in the community, what is it that has kept the process of a food policy sort of on the sidelines until now, and what has made it able to come forward now? What has changed consciousness or awareness that's like opened the door, the internal door in people's minds in government circles and other ways to say, okay, we got to do it now?
I think for me, when I joined council, is identifying that we had a agreed upon stance on food security, and realizing that, you know, each councilor has, by the fact that what you just described, there's a lot of busyness as a councilor. There's a lot of busy work that necessarily doesn't directly, you know, fulfill some of the things you personally want to see happen. So for me, it's really narrowing down what I'm trying to achieve, being very focused on what I want to do, and just look for opportunities. And we were talking about, you know, the difference between introvert and extrovert. I describe myself as an introvert is that I fill up on people at a certain point. I love people. It's just that I fill up on the interaction at a certain point. Whereas an extrovert is like my wife, Ellen. She's an extrovert, and she gets energized. The more people, like it's stadium of 50,000.
Bring me more.
She wants more. I like that until a certain point where I want to stop. So for my, I think my advantage, though, is something I've always really leaned on is the ability to listen. I really prefer listening versus doing what I'm doing right now, which is talking, although I do like the sound of my voice.
It's a very nice voice, Dave. Thank you. I want you to know that.
I've been practicing.
Dave, you've played a role that's directly related to food with the municipality, and that is the introduction of an initiative to develop a food and urban agricultural plan. Let's talk about the nuts and bolts of what was enacted when you tabled a motion on January 22nd of this year at a city council meeting that day. And there were elements to this. It wasn't just, it was thought through. It was carefully thought through. Mm-hmm. What was the essential principle in the motion? What did it bring forward?
In essence, to summarize, is find the gaps in our food security as another lane of emergency preparedness. Then you put it in simple terms and it has a simple plan that you can build into will give us that guideline. And I think that will, I'm hoping, and I could predict that it's going to expose things that are going to make people feel very uncomfortable when it's really the data comes out. That will, I think, be a bit of a call of action. And there's already people here, like we've already spoken to the Food Action Committee, and there's tons of Zest is another example that the great work of SAIDS is doing, Atlanta Fit and that team. These are all smaller and, you know, important pieces that we're all coming together. But I think it's, thank you for this interview. I thank you for the program. I think what it does is summarize for people to know that people care about this. So if you do have these interests and you do feel like you want to step forward, this is the time to get off the sideline, grab a shovel, let's get this going.
Interestingly, there are other counselors as well who I think favor this process and want it to move forward. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because, of course, it's construed, any new program in a municipal government is construed as work because it is work. And when you do work in one project, you can't put as much effort into other projects. What's happening in July, which is when the report that you have stimulated by your notice of motion is to be delivered, what are the ingredients in this report that will be salient and will have an impact, or we hope, everyone hopes will have an impact on advancing food security and food sovereignty? What are the key elements as you see it?
Identifying grant funding and our participation as a municipality in pursuing them. It's a project that staff, I mean, we have a wonderful staff in Salmon Arm, but they're just limited time in a day. You know, and there's lots, if you look at our society right now, there is a lot of competing problems that need our attention. So I think, you know, it helps that we have this process to have this report done. But it's a small step. It's going to fall somewhere between, you know, being as helpful as we wish and not as helpful as we fear, somewhere in there. And again, it's just a step. Again, you're right. You prep the soil. You got to prep, you know, the next steps, you got to plan it out. This is the process. This is, you know, literally we're doing on the municipal level, we're farming the idea. This is what we're at right now.
The art of the possible, I think, is the phrase that most people use for governance.
Can I just add there is that I see it as a two-prong right now from my very limited experience, but this is how I see if we're going to organize this, is that we have the municipal plan that's going to show gaps in security. We're also working on the Agricultural Advisory Committee. We're working in that realm, and not just necessarily through the committee itself, but with the farmers, to finally have a level of collective information gathering, loosely held organization. Again, we've had these in the past. This is not new, but we need it now. And that will be from the water usage. And that will help with land use. That will also help with the algae blooms and you know, identifying where this extra you know, nutrients that are reaching back into the lake. And it's not necessarily all the farmers' issues. A lot of it has to do with how we've handled our ditching and how letting farms get overran by the floodwaters, and then the water recedes back. You know, because if you know a farmer, they're very price and expense conscious. They don't want to lose all their work into the ditch. And yeah, it goes back into the lake. That's, again, just a systemic issue that we will need groups of us to work together to solve.
I'm going to remind listeners that I'm speaking with Dave Ganella, who is a counselor for the city of Salmon Arm, executive director of Salmon Arm's Roots and Blues, and also, as we speak, currently the deputy mayor. What happens when you're the deputy mayor, Dave?
I'm still trying to figure that out, actually. No, to be honest, it's all the ceremonial duties that the mayor would normally occupy. If the mayor is not able to attend council, I will be assumed the mayor's chair, which I have to tell you, there's a lot of gadgetry and tech now in that chair. It is terrifying. There's no gavel.
You shut just somebody off and you turn somebody off on.
No, it feels like someone's giving you a blindfold and a cigarette, and just you hope for it to go well, kind of thing.
Yes, don't put it in your ear. Don't put it in your ear.
No.
When the report that you will have, when the report comes out, I guess you won't be deputy mayor anymore, so you'll have maybe five minutes more time each day. Mm-hmm. What do you hope the reception to be? I mean, is there a plan for sort of public forums and that kind of thing? If it is a challenging report and it's bringing out new ideas for the municipal governance system, but it's also going to bring some ideas that are challenging for the community as a whole. What do you think is the best way for a new, this is an exercise in bringing a new policy. What's the best way to do it, or the way you would like to have this particular change in policy brought forward?
Well, I think it's going to be, again, it's going to be a long process. The steps are still to be clarified. We're right now, I mean, 11 years ago, as we went through the OCP, this is the moment now, is to have real input from the community in the official community plan. I mean, literally, this is your opportunity to define and declare what kind of city you want. How do you want, you know, how do we want to see our zoning in the city?
The province is actually just passed a regulation saying that single dwelling housing can be divided into more units or something along those lines.
Yeah, Bill 44, 45, and 46, you know, for your policy wonks out there. That policy is allowing us to revision the single home property. Going from R1, it's going to allow us to expand how many abodes can be on that space, which is pretty exciting. One part that I'm still concerned about is, you know, the one size fits all kind of plan. It just, you know, from experience, you know, living along with it, that always like
never works.
It just, there's a point of where we're going to find out what doesn't work. But I think what needed to be done was simplifying the process for developers to have multi-unit housing on these properties. Yeah. That's what we had to do.
I think if you went back to any large city in Europe, and especially in Italy, you would find that development projects that go from one end of a block to another, or, you know, a long distance where all the housing is contiguous. It's all, you know, apartments hooked up to each other. Mm-hmm. Even in Montreal and eastern cities in Canada, that's the rule. Yeah. In this part of the world, it's a little bit of the Wild West. You know, you have your own ranch, you have your own homestead.
Yep.
And I think this change in thinking is while it will be challenging for some people, it's contributing very much to moving towards adapting to climate change.
It is.
Because it reduces heating and cooling costs, it reduces building materials, it reduces greenhouse gas production. Mm-hmm. And getting back to what you writing in your article and the concerns you have and the concerns for future generations. I think what this food policy initiative is doing in a way, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's thinking about those future generations. It's saying we have to do something, we have to change things for their sake.
Well, inherently, farming is thinking of the future.
Yes.
Inherently. I mean, that you are always predicting, you're always trying to forecast. So for someone from a farming community, it just seems like lockstep with just the normal process. And yeah, having kids is really a good, incentive to think of the future.
The future is, as somebody said, the future is now. And one of the things that's happening with the climate issue, because I'm very involved with it through physicians organizations. And one of the things that we have become aware of very much in the last 5 years is how vested interests had been established for a very long time. They're not bad people. They're just the people who've been playing a dominant role in the structure of many parts of our social matrix. They are uncomfortable with losing the positions they have, and so they are working sometimes quite hard. As you, I'm sure, know, the fossil fuel industry has been very forthright in saying we don't want to lose an inch in our bulwark. We want to maintain as much as possible. What's that like for you now in a public responsibility position, dealing with these competing interests, the old guard, if you like, that wants things to stay the same, the new generations coming in that recognize that change has to take place, and someone like yourself trying to arbitrate and manage. This is project management on about the largest scale you can imagine. The entire community is the project. What's that like as an experience for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm often thinking of target management. Where do I target? Because it's huge. I'm just one person. Mm-hmm. I have, my own background. I have, knowledge, but it's limited in most of these things. And just to be honest, I think the industry that, natural gas and oil industry is an industry that's going to be with us, like it or not, for a very long time. And we, as a collective, have to figure out how we want to use that resource. I mean, the thing about it is we talk about how precious fresh water is. It is precious, but I'm not sure why we're not saying anything about, oil that comes from the ground that we can make anything with. Mm-hmm. We can make anything with this stuff. And for our futures, the fact that we're burning it as fast as we possibly can is in itself insane.
Yes.
Beyond the climate results, it's like this magic material that we can do anything with, and we're just, so it's, for me, it's a resource management issue. We're misusing the resource, and we're going to have to accept that the industry is going to be there, and we're going to have to figure out how do we transition that industry, the people who are involved. Yeah, there is a corporate giant. Yes, they have a board. Yes, people, you can have your say about how ethical they are or not, but there's still there are people who are having families in trying to live that we cannot just suddenly say forget. Because that's the problem right now, is the argument is that it has to be gone, but we're not giving them any kind of transition. So I think this is where we keep on hitting this wall of why we're not seeing the adaptation as quickly.
Yeah, I would say that now, and this probably wasn't true 20 years ago, but now the phrase just transition has become pretty much dominant in most environmental circles. The organization I'm part of, called the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, that's central. There's no sense that you terminate something. It's that you transform it into something else that's equally livable. Mm-hmm. And there's been an organization in Alberta that's been arguing, of workers in the oil patch, arguing for shutting down the oil patch, but giving the people who work there some kind of job, because you can't just throw people out of work because you don't like what they're doing, unless it's criminal, and it's definitely not criminal. It's a resource industry that's been in place for a very long time. So you transform what they do to a different pattern so that they have the justice that all of us would like. Mm-hmm. I think proceeding in social transformation without a sense of what is just and what is fair is a non-starter. Is that what I sense you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we look at the industries that have gone in the gone by era, the whaling industry, we have the fishing industries that have had major impact to adjust to the reality of their industries.
One of the elements in our community that is bringing us face to face with other ways of doing things and ways that are maybe more sustainable in the long run are our Indigenous friends and neighbors, and they're talking to us now. We didn't listen to them, so they didn't talk to us much. But they're listening. They're talking now because we are starting to learn how to listen to them.
That's it.
What kind of role have you seen this now that you're in the sort of public space? And of course, Roots and Blues is part of that as well. What role have you seen Indigenous voices playing in the transition, both the need for the transition, but also a need for doing it in a just and fair way?
I've been, very fortunate to work with some very valuable and amazing people from the Squamish Nation. Joyce Canoris is a name that I have had lots of great conversations with, and she's, been a kind of lean on her as my knowledge leader. I would say Louis Thomas is another person who's just has a certain quality of translating a story into a meaningful learning experience. And that, rolls right into Kenton Thomas, who I can't say anything bad about.
He's part of the amusing part of Canada. He is a wonderful storyteller.
He is a wonderful storyteller, and his ability to be personable in his stories is probably his most amazing aspect. And, those individuals have made me understand the impact of how the land is so important to them. And not just from a yield kind of view, right? As like having a farmer's background, you always look at the farm and you say, what can it yield for me? But they look at it as more sacred, and not just what's produced, but what it is.
Its value lies in its existence.
Yes.
Yeah. There's a move towards, and it's inspired by Indigenous teachings, towards the rights of nature. In other words, nature doesn't have to make us money in order to be valuable. Nature is inherently valuable in and of itself.
Yeah, they're trying to do an economic study on the value of the earth and what it actually is, the value. So when you look at, that kind of study can give you an idea of what, if you're misusing it, what is actually the loss if you're actually misusing it?
It's basically loss of everything. That's what it amounts to. Dave Ganella, councillor for the city of Salmon Arm. Dave, it's been wonderful to have you in the studio and to talk to you about some really important changes that are taking place in City Hall, but also in the community at large, and the interface between the two, because it's something that affects all of us. It's something that is a challenge. I'll tell you a little secret. I wasn't going to vote for you because I was afraid your head would explode. I was afraid that if you kept the executive director of Roots and Blues, and you were a counselor, and now you're cultural events director for the BC 55 Plus Games, and you're deputy mayor of Salmon Arm, nobody could do this. This is not within the realm of human capacity. But talking to you today, I am greatly reassured that you're navigating this busy, but also, I think, meaningful course in a way that is a credit to you and a benefit to the community. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Warren, for having me.